5 European Union member states called for a summit to discuss, quote, the huge disparities in the coronavirus vaccine rollout in the bloc. AstraZeneca vaccine is in short supply as the European Union takes a closer look at what's going on. And Bolivia's former interim president is arrested in connection with a 2019 political crisis that forced the then-president, Evo Morales, to resign and flee the country. Hello and welcome from Tehran. You're tuned to World News. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Appreciate you all joining us. First story takes us to the EU this hour, where Austria, the Czech Republic, Slovenia, Bulgaria, and Latvia have called for a European Union summit to discuss what they call the unfair distribution of the coronavirus vaccines. The five EU states have sent a letter to the bloc's top officials to complain about, quote, the huge disparities in vaccine handouts. They say deliveries of doses to member states are not being implemented on an equal basis. Now, the letter notes that under the current distribution system, only some nations would reach herd immunity. Austrian Chancellor Sebastian Kurz has suggested that several EU states may have signed secret contracts with vaccine companies to receive more doses. Meanwhile, the pharmaceutical giant AstraZeneca has announced a fresh shortfall in vaccine shipments to the EU. The company has cited production problems and export restrictions for the shortfall. Jerome Hughes says the distribution of COVID-19 vaccines in Europe has turned into a political crisis.
You have countries in Europe now, seven countries, in fact, that have either stopped using AstraZeneca altogether or restricted the use of AstraZeneca. And we're talking about Denmark, Norway, Austria, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, and Luxembourg. So this is adding to the problems. Now, you mentioned the five countries that want a summit to discuss the problem. Yes, there are also issues there in terms of how these, which governments or which countries are getting the vaccines that they asked for, that they were promised. So there are issues there. That is legitimate that they want a summit. But the problem there, of course, is that, you know, they are under massive pressure now. And we've been covering these stories now for a year. And they're under massive pressure to try and get their act together, to get their heads around the vaccination strategy, the vaccination rollout. So, yes, they're calling for a summit and they're blaming the European Commission or they're blaming the pharmaceutical companies, but also they have to take some blame themselves. And so this is turning into a political issue. It's not just a social crisis. It's not just an economic crisis. It's not just a health crisis. It's now turning into a political crisis for these government leaders.
Meanwhile, Iran has reported 73 more coronavirus fatalities, raising the death toll to more than 61,000. The health ministry says more than 7,800 new infections have been registered since Thursday. That brings the overall caseload to over 1.7 million. 1.5 million people have managed to recover from the deadly disease. Iran implemented strict coronavirus measures in November of last year, which resulted in a decline in the number of deaths and infections. But the figures have been ascending since new cases of the UK variant were detected in several parts of the country. Investigations show that the Israeli regime is the prime suspect in a terrorist attack on an Iranian container ship in the Mediterranean Sea. A member of the technical team inspecting the damage to the vessel says the probability of Israel's involvement in the terrorist attack is very strong. The investigators cite the geographical location of the ship and the way it was targeted as the reasons for the finding. The inspector says explosive projectiles, possibly fired from a flying device, struck the ship's containers from above and caused the fire. The Iran Shah Court was attacked in international waters en route to Europe on Wednesday. Iranian Foreign Ministry says the act of sabotage is in clear violation of international law. It has vowed to take measures to identify the perpetrators. Continue to other news this hour. Palestinians in Gaza have held a rally to mark the Palestinian Wounded Persons Day, paying homage to the victims of Israeli attacks. Israel's use of unconventional weapons during its wars and aggression have increased the number of injured among Palestinians. Ashraf Shannon reports.
Palestinians in the blockaded Gaza Strip rallied to mark the 53rd anniversary of the Palestinian Wounded Persons Day. The annual event pays tribute to the tens of thousands of Palestinians who got injured during Israeli wars and aggressions. During the 2014 war on Gaza, Israeli forces killed over 2,200 Gazans, including women and children, with more than 11,000 people wounded. Thousands of injured Palestinians suffered from permanent disabilities during Israeli wars.
I was injured as a teenager and lost both of my legs, and there are thousands like me, especially children, who will suffer throughout their lives because of the Israeli crimes. Israeli forces have committed war crimes against us.
During a press conference, Palestinian factions slammed the normalization of ties between the Israeli regime and some Arab countries, especially in the Persian Gulf region. Hamas movement said normalization encourages the Israeli regime to commit more crimes against the Palestinians.
We condemn the United Arab Emirates for its normalization and support for the Zionist entity, especially its decision to make investments in the Zionist entity that perpetrates crimes against our people. On the Palestinian Wounded Persons Day, we stress that Israeli leaders must be held accountable for their war crimes and their crimes against humanity.
Israeli forces have injured some 30,000 peaceful Palestinian protesters since March 30th, 2018, who were taking part in the Great March of Return rallies. Wounded Palestinians say that Tel Aviv's crimes will continue to go unpunished as long as it enjoys protection from Western countries.
Wounded people are living witnesses to Israeli war crimes. Every time I look at my amputated hand, I relive the honor of my injury. I blame Western countries, especially Britain, for my suffering.
Thousands of people in the Gaza Strip suffered from different disabilities in recent years due to Israel's use of internationally banned weapons during Israeli wars and frequent military operations.
Israel's use of banned weapons increased the number of disabled Palestinians. Such weapons cause amputations of upper and lower limbs among innocent Palestinians during wars and during peaceful protests. We demand an immediate end to Israeli crimes.
Israel's callous disregard for human life continues to inflict pain and suffering on Palestinians.
Israeli forces have killed and maimed thousands of Palestinians in the Gaza Strip, including women and children, since 2008, amid what observers describe as an international conspiracy of silence. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
A British police officer has been charged with kidnapping and murdering a woman who disappeared in South London earlier this month. Wayne Cousins was charged after the body of 33-year-old Sarah Everett was recovered in Kent County on Friday. The officer serving in the Metropolitan Police Department was arrested earlier this week in the same county where he lives. Everett was last spotted on March the 3rd, walking home alone. Police say an investigation is still underway to find the details of the murder. Cousins is due to appear in a court to face charges on Saturday. While the case has sparked widespread anger about the safety of women, lawmakers have denounced gender violence and have paid tribute to more than 100 women killed over the past year in the UK. New Zealand has held the commemoration ceremony to mark the second anniversary of the deadly terrorist attacks on mosques in the city of Christchurch. Several hundred people, including Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern, attended the emotional remembrance service, which was also live-streamed. 51 worshippers were killed in two consecutive mass shootings at two mosques during Friday prayers in 2019. Both attacks were carried out by a single terrorist. Brenton Tarrant, a white supremacist, opened fire on worshippers, live-streamed the carnage, and posted a racist manifesto online. The attacker had legally bought five assault weapons, including two semi-automatic rifles that he used in the massacre. He was arrested shortly afterwards and sentenced to life without parole. Abdurrazak, the chairman of the Federation of Islamic Associations of New Zealand, says New Zealand apologized to Muslims and adopted measures to beef up security after the 2019 mosque shootings.
The Prime Minister of New Zealand apologized to the Muslims, which is a very seminal and a very sincere apology which was given. That apology was followed up by the police as well as the Security Intelligence Service. Now they've appointed a very senior minister as a coordinating minister to make all the changes that the Royal Commission suggested, which was 44 recommendations. And most of the, in fact, all the recommendations are as of the Royal Commission submission that we made. So we see the direction taking place where there will be, and process has started, of some significant changes in the whole security and the intelligence apparatus, both the police and the NZSIS. Well, in New Zealand, it's a completely different context. What we don't have here is the politics, which you see more in Europe, where the politicians use Muslims as a scapegoat for their own political ends. In New Zealand, you don't have that. In New Zealand, we have a small country where the Muslims have played a long, you know, it's a long history. We've been here since 1769.
And now it's time for this hour's news review. Well, Bolivia's former President Evo Morales has demanded punishment for those who orchestrated what he called a coup against his government in 2019. That after the former interim president was arrested on sedition charges. Morales says authors and accomplices of the dictatorship must be investigated and sanctioned. His comments came after Bolivian minister announced on social media the apprehension of Anas and several ex-officials by police. An arrest warrant was issued after prosecutors said Anas took part in a coup against Morales. The detainees face terrorism, sedition, and conspiracy charges. Anas, a former senator, took over as interim leader after Morales fled the country amid military pressure and violent protests against his re-election. Morales returned to Bolivia after his party won the election again last October. I'd like to welcome our guests to this news review, Isaac Vigio, academic journalist and commentator out of London, and Ali Vargas, journalist and commentator out of Bolivia. Thank you both for being with us. Let's start off with London and Isaac. Isaac, tell me about the significance of this, that actually the one who was part of the coup against Morales, now she's under arrest along with others.
Well, you have to understand that according to the Bolivian constitution, if the president resigns, he or she has to be replaced by the vice president or the chair of the Senate or the deputies. But what happened? The army demanded that Evo Morales left power, so it was a kind of a coup d'etat, and then there was a political vacuum, and Mrs. Áñez said that she is going to be the president, but she was not the chair of the Senate House or the deputy house, not even the vice president of any of these houses, and she decided to be president without the support of the Congress, of the National Assembly. So she was put in power by the army, by the police, and in the demonstration when she was proclaimed as president, there were only 10, 20, 30 people. But in the previous hours, there was a big demonstration of 10,000 people demanding that she should not take power because she's a racist. She said that the Indians should go outside the cities, that they have a diabolic religion, and she, in her first months of in government, she killed more people per day than the days every calendar month. So she was like a military coup. She violated the constitution, and then she tried to persecute Evo Morales and many leaders of the socialist movement as terrorist, sedition, subversive, and everything. Now she has to be put in jail because she broke the constitution and she killed tens of innocent civilians with guns, and she has to be put in a trial.
Okay, well, let me get Ali in on this discussion. Let's take it even outside of Bolivia itself and the significance, Ali, because we know that the U.S. Actually supported that coup. The significance of the change of events with last year with Evo Morales' party being reelected, Evo returning to the country, the significance of what has happened from an international sense, we know that the United States at will would support coup d'etats or change leaders. Is the tide changing somewhat?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's an interesting question, not just in regards to Bolivia, but the region as a whole. So last year in October the 18th, the Movement Towards Socialism, which is a left-wing party opposed to U.S. intervention in the region, won by a landslide. We now have also seen a similar party in Ecuador, known as the Correista Left Party, running under the name of UNES, also came first in the first round presidential elections this year in February. So, and they're going to have their second round on the 11th of April. We've also seen charges lifted against former Brazilian President Lula da Silva. All polls show him as the most popular political figure in the country. So I think very soon we could have a left tide in the southern cone of Latin America, that is Argentina, Brazil, Bolivia, stretching up to Ecuador. Mexico is also another country that has elected a government on the basis of popular sovereignty. So I think this is a very interesting time in Latin America, particularly at a time where countries are looking to rebuild economies during the pandemic. Bolivia has, at the moment, a president who is an economist, a Marxist economist. The presidential candidate in Ecuador is also a socialist economist. So I think we could have some very interesting ideas coming out of Latin America. But I think also this, what we've seen today, what we saw yesterday with the arrest of Janine Añez, shows that the left in Latin America was never defeated at the ballot box. It was defeated through the use of force. The Movement Towards Socialism never lost an election in Bolivia. They've won every single election that they've stood in since 2005. However, democratic rule was interrupted by, under the leadership of this person, Janine Añez, who seized power but couldn't hold on to it for more than a year. Very similar situation in Ecuador. Lenin Moreno was elected as a left-wing candidate, as the protege of Rafael Correa, but he then turned to the right once in power. But people didn't vote for that. People voted for him as the vice president of Rafael Correa. So I think we're now seeing those forces that impose themselves with the backing of the United States. We're seeing that sort of peel away now because they never had popular support at a significant level. And Añez, she left the presidency with an approval rating in the single figures around 8%. And now she's in jail. She's been arrested for pre-trial detention, something that the majority of Bolivians have been calling for a very long time, so that there can be justice for the massacres that took place in November of 2019. And this is incredibly important because if there isn't justice now, if there is impunity now, then you're going to have the same situation repeat itself tomorrow.
Right.
In 1-2 years, be another coup. And so this is an incredibly important signal for the whole world.
Thanks so much for being with us on this news review. Isaac Vigio, academic journalist and commentator out of London, and Ali Vargas, a journalist and commentator out of Chacabamba, Bolivia.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Second phase of the revolution.
Of the revolution. Of the revolution.
Leap in production.
Agriculture and natural resources are among the most important economic sectors due to their vital role in food security in the country. Natural resources have high capabilities in providing favorable agricultural lands and maintenance, rich genetic capacities for reinforcement of economic infrastructure. Iran's agricultural sector makes up 9.3% of the country's GDP or gross domestic product, 20.8% of employment, and 20% of the value of non-oil exports. It has relatively preserved its place within the economy of the country. Statistics indicate that through numerous programs in agriculture during the five-year plans, production of agricultural crops has had a sustainable and increasing growth despite dry years. Thus, agricultural production in Iran has increased from 20 million tons in 1977 to more than 94 million tons in 2011. Thus, the country's self-sufficiency has exceeded 93%. Statistics show that in the past year, the Ministry of Agricultural Jihad has managed to attain great achievements, including qualitative and quantitative improvements of produce, especially strategic crops, self-reliance in production of basic foods, and preservation of natural resources. Agricultural sector with over 4 million operators and more than 5% annual growth has paved the ground for attaining 7.8% economic growth and 6.4% absorption of foreign exchange through exports. Leap in production in agriculture is in direct relation with resources and infrastructure. One of the main factors for leap in production is securing water needed for cultivation of crops. Fortunately, water reserves have increased in the past 2 years due to heavy rainfall. In view of this, creation of necessary infrastructure and development within the framework of economy of resistance will set the ground for national development and economic security through proper management. According to government statistics, there are immense potentials in Iran in the field of agriculture. Therefore, gaining access to leap in agricultural produce is by no means far-fetched, given the availability of auxiliary industries and modern technologies. Of course, there are deficiencies and obstacles on the way which can be removed via inexhaustible endeavor and selfless management. Currently, there is a surplus in production of many crops in some of the provinces. Therefore, preservation of this surplus amount needs convertible industries and enhancement and increase of packaging equipment and transportation facilities. Dr. Hoshyar Fahd, a research and university professor, is of the opinion that agriculture enjoys a meager share of investment in the country in spite of high share within the gross domestic product or GDP. He said investment in agricultural research, development and technology will bear positive fruit, stressing that this will increase the role of private sector in this field. Dr. Khoshruzadeh, a specialist in communication technologies from the Malaysian UPM University, also emphasizes on the need to invest in smart technologies in agriculture. He says, one of the methods that can contribute to a leap in production in the agricultural sector is exploitation of modern technologies. Today, many countries make use of smart technologies to minimize costs and optimize use of resources. This is very economical. Use of unmanned aerial vehicles or UAVs can also help to enhance the health of products, irrigation, spraying, and analysis of soil. Organizing and integration of small farms is another solution that Dr. Khoshruzadeh suggests for a leap in agricultural production. Seed modification in agriculture and breed modification in animal husbandry should also be taken into account. It is predicted that there will be a substantial leap in production in the agricultural sector given the existence of appropriate infrastructure, especially in the field of water management. Experts have also predicted that the area under farm crops, such as wheat and barley, will increase to 5,000 hectares due to suitable water resources. It is estimated that the performance of this sector will grow by up to 30%. Having a share of nearly 12% of the country's gross domestic product or GDP, a leap in production in agricultural produce will not only develop different economic and social activities, but also it will reduce the impact of national threats such as economic sanctions. It will also prevent damage to the economy. To achieve the motto of the year, leap in production, all capacities should be exploited properly. Leap in production will move with two wings of industry and agriculture.
Ocean of Dua.
إني أسألك الهدى والتقى والعفاف والغنى.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, dear listeners, brothers and sisters, I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Rarsi, and we're going to be with you with another edition of The Ocean of Dua. In this version of the program, inshallah, we will discuss the true meaning of prayer and dua, the value of prayer, ways of reaching the Almighty Allah, acceptance, and also benefits of dua. So stay with us. Brothers and sisters, as you may have been previously with us, we were talking about and discussing the concept of stand, which appears right after testimony, and these two are among the two important elements of what appears in the text of our ziyarat. With regard to stand, we try to define it and familiarize you with it, with its different aspects, and we try to count some of the different properties and some of the requirements for that. We counted some of them, like friendship and dissociation, peace and submission, the last of which was praying for revenge. Now, in our ziyarat, we can somehow have another look, with the framework of personal relationship. It is within this framework that the state of mutual exchange in this relationship becomes more distinct and stronger, and the phenomenon of give and take between the Zair and the Mazur becomes even more active. We said that there are two sides when someone who is visitor and someone who is the visited. And in this relationship, among the most important features which becomes manifest as a result of the relation between Zair and Mazur is the prayer for the Holy Prophet and his progeny.
Alhamdulillahi khaliq al-khalq basit al-rizq faliq al-asbah dhil jalali wal-ikram wal-fadli wal-in'am alladhi ba'uda fala yura wa qaruba fashahida an-najwa.
We have seen throughout the text of ziyarat that they start with sending blessings on the Holy Prophet and his progeny. We seek Allah's mercy for them. And for example, we say, O Allah, bless Muhammad and his household with a blessing by which you will make for them plentiful your gifts and generosity, and you will perfect for them your bestowals and awards, and fill out their share of your kindly acts and benefits. We read in the ziyarah of the Holy Prophet O Allah, bless Muhammad and his progeny, and send your benedictions on Muhammad and his household, the best you have blessed. The best you have sent benedictions, showered mercy, showed affection, and sent salutations on Ibrahim and the progeny of Ibrahim. Another important feature that is manifest in our text of ziyarat is praying for the Holy Prophet and his progeny, that may Allah make them mediators to his mercy for his servants. And somehow we pray that the Almighty Allah makes them intercessors with him on their behalf. A phrase in the ziyarah of the Holy Prophet ﷺ reads, O Allah, give Muhammad the mediation, honor, excellence, and a noble position. O Allah, confer on Muhammad the most honorable station, the gift of peace, and intercession for the followers of Islam. Join us with him such that we are not ashamed, nor among those who have broken their promise, nor regretful.
Why do we make supplication? And why do we call out to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? Is it because God is not aware of our needs? God is Al-Alim. He knows all of our needs. Is it because God needs convincing? God is known as Al-Jawad. He is the source of generosity. Then why am I making dua to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? The dua is a journey of realizations. When a person goes to the ocean and he takes with him a bucket that can carry 4 liters of water, the ocean is infinite. In as much as your vessel is large, that is the amount of water that the ocean will give you. And therefore, our goal is to expand our capacity. Rumi has a very beautiful poem. He says, "Har khujo mushkil javab onjo ravad." Wherever there is a problem, that is where the answer will come. Har khujo keshti ab onjo ravad. Wherever there is a vessel, that's where the water will come. Ab kamju tishnagi avar bedast. Don't go seeking for water. Instead, create the thirst within you. Tabeju shad ab az bala bast. So that the water may burst forth from above and from below you. Experience that realization that you need God, and the mercy will God will come towards you. Paradise, thank you Allah, now that we're here, feeling so good about all the things that we went through, knowing that God is pleased with us too. It's not a dream, this is so true, and we know we'll be here forever.
The ocean of dua.
Another feature that can be understood in the framework of personal relationship between desire and mazur is seeking recourse with the Holy Prophet ﷺ and his progeny, and implore for their intercession with the permission of Allah. When we say, "O Allah, make me distinguished in your eyes in this world and hereafter, for the sake of Muhammad and his household. O Prophet of Allah, I turn with your help toward Allah, your Lord and my Lord, that he may forgive me my sins." When we say all these beautiful phrases and words, we are asking for shafa'a, an intercession of those infallible imams. For example, in the ziyarah of Hamza alayhi salam, the uncle of the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, we say, "I have come to you from a distant place, asking you to set my soul free from the fire, as my back has been burdened with my sins. I have committed what enrages my Lord. I find no one to flee to better for me than you, the household of mercy. So be my intercessor." So we have counted some of the most important features that are manifest in the relationship between desire and the mazur. We will talk about one more important feature in the next program. Thank you for staying with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
British women flooded social media with posts about the steps they take when out alone at night to keep safe, including catching keys to use as a weapon and wearing trainers to help them run. Many raged at the violence against women that made them feel they had to take such measures. I prepare for you an article written jointly by Michael Holden and David Milliken under the heading, London Murder Case Triggers Wave of Grief, Rage Over Threats to Women. The article has been published by the Reuters news agency. Please stay with us for more of Michael Holden and David Milliken's article. Women in Britain poured out their fears and anger over how unsafe they feel walking the streets after the disappearance of a woman in Clapham, South London, and the arrest of a police officer on suspicion of a kidnap and murder. Sarah Everard, a 33-year-old, was last seen at 9:30 p.m. local time on 3rd of March as she walked home from a friend's house in South London. Her image, smiling at the camera, or caught on CCTV that evening, has been splashed across British newspapers all week. Anxiety turned to grief after news late on Wednesday, 3rd of March, that police investigating Everard's disappearance had found remains in a wood outside London, resulting in an outpouring of personal accounts by women of their own experiences and fears. Anna Burley, a 31-year-old, one of the organisers of a planned Reclaim These Streets vigil to honour Sarah Everard and demand change, said, "The disappearance of Sarah and the absolute tragedy around that has really touched a nerve with a lot of women." Anna Burley said, "We feel really angry that it's an expectation put on women that we need to change our behaviour to stay safe. The problem isn't women. The problem is that women aren't safe on our streets." Women flooded social media with posts about the steps they take when out alone at night to keep safe, including clutching keys to use as a weapon and wearing trainers to help them run. Many raged at the violence against women that made them feel they had to take such measures. Others detailed a catalogue of incidents of harassment by men in public over the decades since they were schoolgirls. Britain's Home Secretary Priti Patel said, "These are so powerful because each and every woman can relate," adding, "Every woman should feel safe to walk on our streets without fear of harassment or violence." Legislator Jess Phillips, the opposition Labour Party's policy chief on domestic violence, read out in the chamber of the House of Commons the names of all 118 women murdered by men in the United Kingdom last year. Jessica Phillips said, "The message that needs to be sent is that male violence is something that has to be tackled and challenged, and the justice system and society has to wake up to that." The head of London's police force, Cressida Dick, said she and her colleagues were utterly appalled at news that a police officer had been arrested in connection with Sarah Everard's abduction, sparking a wave of shock and anger. Police on Thursday, 4th of March, were given extra time to question the officer, whose job is to guard diplomatic buildings, on suspicion of kidnap, murder, and indecent exposure. A woman in her 30s, whom media reports said was his wife, was also detained on suspicion of assisting an offender, but has since been released on police bail. England's police watchdog, the Independent Office for Police Conduct, said it had launched an investigation into the London Police Force's handling of the case. The arrested police officer was reported to police on 28th of February over charges of indecent exposure in a South London fast food restaurant several days before Sarah Everard's disappearance. The watchdog also said it would look closer at how the suspect sustained head injuries that required hospital treatment, which police said occurred whilst he was alone in his prison cell. Head of London's police force, Cressida Dick, sought to reassure women, claiming it was incredibly rare for a woman to be abducted from the streets. She said, "But I completely understand that despite this, women in London and the wider public, particularly those in the area where Sarah went missing, will be worried and may well be feeling scared." Although the remains have not yet been formally identified, Sarah Everard's family paid tribute, saying their daughter Sarah was taken from us, and we are appealing for any information that will help to solve this terrible crime. The family said in a statement, "Sarah was a wonderful daughter and sister. She was kind and thoughtful, caring and dependable." Britain's Prime Minister Boris Johnson said he was shocked and deeply saddened by developments in this case. The Reclaim These Streets vigil will take place in coming days in Clapham Common in southwest London, near where Sarah Everard was last seen. The event's organiser wrote on Facebook, "We believe that streets should be safe for women regardless of what you wear, where you live, or what time of the day or night it is." The statement added, "It's wrong that the response to violence against women requires women to behave differently." In comments on social media, women have also been offering to help each other walk together to the event in groups to keep each other safe. Organisers of the Clapham Common Vigil said that police officers had told them the event would not be allowed given current COVID-19 restrictions. Writing on a crowdfunding website to cover legal fees, organisers said they were working with human rights lawyers to challenge the Metropolitan Police's interpretation of coronavirus legislation and are seeking an urgent order from the High Court for the event to go ahead.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The
Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on February 17, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference with the participation of people from Tabriz and East Azerbaijan commemorating the anniversary of the Tabriz uprising of February 18, 1978.
Confronting the enemy by strengthening national identity. Well, from the beginning, the Islamic Revolution faced the enmity of superpowers, and a certain front came into being. One day, they brought up the issue of the nuclear issue, and another day, they brought up the issue of missiles and Iran's regional presence. These are all excuses. The essence of the issue is that the Islamic government is not willing to be a partner to the global system of domination, and it does not wish to cooperate with it in the oppressor-oppressed division of the world. The Islamic government is standing up against oppression and hegemony. Well, in the face of this enmity and this front, our dear and eternal nation needs to strengthen its identity, its personality, and its identity elements, and it should increase its inner powers as well. This is a definite need. What gives identity and power to a nation and a movement? First of all, having a firm ideological infrastructure.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want or need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
The reason why many countries which conducted a revolution and made moves against hegemony, arrogance, oppression and tyranny returned from their path after a short time, some after 5 years, some after 10 years, and took the path of their predecessors and behaved like them was that they did not have a firm ideological infrastructure. When you see foreigners use certain terms, unfortunately, some people inside the country repeat it as well, such as combating ideology. This is what it means. The main enemy of hegemonic powers is this fundamental ideological infrastructure, which is an Islamic one. This infrastructure is based on Islam, and it has been explained in detail in Imam's statements. This Islamic ideological infrastructure is completely radiant there, and our late Imam's wealth of statements is a rich source of information in this regard.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.